Today's service is a collaboration with the Welcoming Congregations Ministry team. This team works to widen the Eshore Circle by conspiring with all the LGBTQIA plus individuals and communities here on the East Side in Seattle, and by leading services and events just like this one to celebrate folks of all genders and sexual identities. So today we celebrate Easter, Transgender Day of Visibility, and Flower Communion. All of these special rituals celebrate beauty, human uniqueness, diversity, and of course, community. These rituals reaffirm the importance of practicing a love that is brave, compassionate, all-embracing. Love that offers us the blessing to keep changing, to keep transforming our hearts, to keep resurrecting hope until all of us are free. It is in this loving spirit that I welcome you. Bienvenidos.
Good morning. Good morning. I am David Langrock, and I use he, him pronouns. And I'm a member of our wonderful Welcoming Congregations team. On this beautiful morning of Trans Day of Visibility, I am honored to introduce our very special guest speaker. Dr. Jamison Green is an author, educator, public speaker, independent legal scholar, and consulting expert in transgender health and employment discrimination litigation. In the 1990s, he led the world's largest support and information group for trans men and had a major impact on the changing laws and policies in support of all trans people in the United States and in many other countries. Now he serves as a policy consultant for business, educational, and governmental institutions. He was the first American trans person elected president of the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, or WPATH. And he served on WPATH's board of directors from 2003 to 2018. Now he co-leads WPATH's ethics committee. He is also the author of a prize-winning book, Becoming a Visible Man, from Vanderbilt University Press, first published in 2004. A revised second edition was released in 2020, and an audiobook was launched on Audible in 2022. I highly recommend this book. It is a deeply touching memoir. It touched me, as well as an enlightening telling of trans men's journeys as they endeavor to find each other, build community, and just be who they are. This book shows me how my ignorance alienates me from this community of men, as it also encourages me to consider how I strike balance between the hidden attributes of my personality that I protect and those I want others to see. Please give a warm East Shore welcome to Dr. Jamison Green.
Thank you, David, for your kind introduction, and thank you to the entire Welcoming Congregations team and Reverend Dr. Maria Cristina for extending the invitation to me to speak with you today, with you all today. I'm grateful for this opportunity on such a special day. It is Easter. A day of transformation, of resurrection, of miracles and magnificence. It is also March 31st, the day designated as Transgender Day of Visibility. This is a happy coincidence for me because I am a transgender man. I am not a Christian, though I grew up in a Presbyterian home. And my parents ensured that my younger brother and I were participants in that community when we were young. We were lucky, though, that our parents told us that we could be free to choose our faith when we grew up. Their primary goal for us around religion was to choose a faith that would remind us of they wanted us to respect the faith of others, first and foremost. But their primary goal was that we find a spiritual community that would remind us that the world did not revolve around us, that there was something out there that was bigger than us. My brother adopted some of his wife's Catholic faith traditions, and I, on the other hand, was attracted to nature, to finding a balance in my life, to being part of the living, breathing universe of elemental life. When the daffodils miraculously appeared in my front yard earlier this month, I was filled with joy and hope for the future. That is resurrection. That is the miracle of spring. When living things arise from the earth and remind humans that we are alive, that is the Easter that I celebrate. These days, as you all probably know, transgender people are under attack in many parts of the world. We are rejected, ridiculed, and criminalized, attacked and murdered, only because some very loud and very well-funded people have decided they can demonize us and capitalize on other people's willingness to be part of a crowd that thrives on hatred, misinformation, indignance, and fear. Transgender Day of Visibility is a resurrection. It originated in 2009 when Rachel Crandall, a transgender activist in Michigan, decided that she had waited long enough for someone else to create the commemorative day that celebrated the living, joyful transgender people. Since the time of the first Gay Freedom Day parade in 1970, commemorating the Stonewall riots in New York City in 1969, where trans people comprised a significant part of the resistance to police abuse of the queer community, trans people have generally remained on the margins of pride celebrations because the transgender population in any city in the world was and still is dominated by the much larger numbers of gay, lesbian, and bisexual people who frequently control pride events. The trans community's first unique public repeating event was the Transgender Day of Remembrance, started in San Francisco in November of 1999 by trans woman journalist Gwendolyn Smith to commemorate the 1988 murder of Rita Hester, a trans woman in Boston. Gwen was angry that whenever a trans person was murdered, police didn't seem to care enough to make an effort to find the perpetrator, and newspapers didn't report the person's death because they didn't know what to say about someone who had been born with one kind of body but lived as if they had another kind of body. Gwen was determined that our trans siblings not be discarded and forgotten. Admittedly, it can be confusing if you don't know that trans people have always existed. Always. We're not some freaky phenomenon that was invented for the internet. We're not all about sex work or prostitution. And we're not crazy. We're a natural part of human variation that has been documented by anthropologists and historians throughout the world in every race, class, every culture since the beginning of known civilizations. In different epochs and in different languages, there have always been different words for what we now, in the English language, call transgender or trans people. We're a population still developing a language. For hundreds of years, we were assumed to be some kind of extreme homosexual, but our difference was not our sexual orientation, but our gender identity. It was not about who we wanted to be with, but about who we knew ourselves to be. I'll tell you just a bit of my own story as an example, but remember, not all trans people are alike in their transformation process or in how they come to find themselves. When you've met one trans person, you have met one trans person. I've found, though, that through sharing our stories, understanding and openness to learning increases. I make myself visible so that others can find the courage to tell their stories. And because visibility increases understanding, which increases our social safety. For the first 14 years of my life, I tried to be the daughter my parents wanted. After all, they had chosen me. I was adopted, not an accident of birth for them. My adoptive parents had gone through the screening and waited over a year for the call that came in December 1948, informing them that there were several baby girls available who fit their profile. They were invited to come in and select one. I was 4 weeks old. My mother later told me I was the first baby they brought out for her to, and for her and my father to see. And after a few minutes of inspection, the officials offered to bring out another available infant. But my mother protested, "No, I don't want to see any others. This one is fine." She told me she didn't want to feel as though she'd chosen her daughter like she'd selected the best cabbage at the grocery store. I was glad they chose me, but by the time I was 3 years old, I felt they were growing uncomfortable with me. I knew they loved me, but they were increasingly frustrated with my insistence on wearing boys' clothes. In elementary school, in fact, all the way through high school, I had to wear skirts or dresses to school. There was no getting around it. In the second grade, I had seen a particular brand of black high-top tennis shoes on TV that promised to make me run faster and jump higher than any other shoes. I just had to have them. And I begged my parents to buy me a pair. After weeks of resistance, they miraculously agreed that the world wouldn't end if I wore those shoes for playing sports. I was ecstatic. At the shoe store, in spite of the salesman's clear surprise that a girl would even want such shoes, he found a pair that fit me, and my mother bought them. On the first day I wore them to school, my teacher called me up to her desk and quietly told me I could not wear those shoes. "Why?" I bellowed. "They are not appropriate shoes for a girl." "But I need them on the playground." "You must go home now and change your shoes. You can bring them back in a box and put them on after the recess bell rings. But you must have your saddle shoes on and those black things put away in the box before the class bell rings." "But..." "No arguments. Those are the rules." I walked home in despair. My mother drove me back to school with my saddle shoes on my feet and my prized high tops in a shoebox. Once the recess bell rang, and by the time I had laced them up, I barely had time to run across the playground before I had to unlace them and switch back to those saddle shoes. I never took the high tops to school again. By seventh grade, I began to rebel by making my own school survival uniform. I wore gym shoes with white athletic socks, a plain pleated skirt, a white button-down Oxford shirt, and either a dark-colored Pendleton shirt or a baggy cotton jacket. For cold weather, I wore a heavy gray wool car coat that was as much like a navy pea coat as I could find. And I never had to struggle with what to wear to school because I wouldn't wear anything else. Yes, people made fun of me. My father, who was generally supportive of me, got mad at me now and then, asking, "Why can't you dress nicely like the other girls?" Sometimes at school or on the street, someone would call me a queer or a dyke. I had no idea what those words meant, but they sounded derogatory to me. Still, I preferred to endure their teasing rather than wear clothing that made me feel like I was living a lie. I was not a total outcast, though. I actually had a lot of friends. I was good at sports, so people wanted me on their teams. I could tell jokes. I could sing and play guitar, and I performed at school assemblies. I did get thrown out of home economics because I was inept, actually mostly uninterested, in the class projects. I was disruptive and told stories and engaged in distracting conversations while the good girls were trying to follow the assigned recipe or master the art of sewing. My counselor the home ec teacher and the woodshop teacher conferred and agreed to give me a chance to do something different. So I was sent to the boys' woodshop class. What a relief that was. At first, the boys laughed and teased me, but before long, it was clear that I was just as good at woodworking and mastering the tools as they were. Since there was no boy in the class named Bill, they started calling me that. It wasn't my right name, but it sure felt better than the very feminine name my parents had given me. For a long time, I had already been trying on names that fit me better. I went through a series of names over the years: Chip, Packy, Squirt, Thor, God of Thunder. I would announce the name to my family and the kids in the neighborhood and just tell me to just call me that for a while. Nobody fought me over it, but then none of those names ever really stuck. Bill was more distinguished than any of my earlier experiments, though it still wasn't quite right. I finally found my name while watching a Man from U.N.C.L.E. TV episode. The story revolved around a mysterious character named Jameson. The main characters on the show, Napoleon Solo and his faithful sidekick, Ilya Kuryakin, were terrified that Jameson was back. Jameson, apparently, was the most accomplished, intelligent, powerful, and intimidating villain.